The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back. Monday, January 14th, 2019. For those of you that have been paying attention, particularly to my monologues in the first hours of these shows, I've kind of worked my way in through the back door to the issue, the ever-engaging issue, and always with us issue of education, primarily K-12 education, elementary and secondary education. On that front, the Arizona Republic has been doing a series on charter schools in Arizona, and I have disagreed fundamentally with so many things in these stories. I think they are, in many cases, op-eds masquerading in news as news stories, given what I know about the situation. Someone who has been pushing back a little bit on it, I should say a lot of bit on it, on Twitter and elsewhere, is a good friend of mine, and he is someone who knows a lot about this issue, and that is Eric Twist. He is the president of the Arizona Great Hearts Academies. He's been involved in the charter school movement and education of our children for many, many, many years. And I wanted to get Eric on. Eric, welcome back. How are you?
Good, Seth. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you very, very much. The series in the Arizona Republic that I've been speaking about seems to me, as I said, you feel free to take it anywhere you want, seems to me to be making things way too simple about the issue and history of charter schools in Arizona. And I wondered if you might just say a few opening comments about it, what you think Arizonans ought to know about charter schools in Arizona.
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think fundamentally, at the very core of what the legislature did was 20 years ago or more, was it really democratized public education. You know, if you think about it, Seth, before charter reform, the only parents that had choice in education were parents with money.
Right.
And what the Arizona legislature did was it allowed for, in many cases, moms and dads and teachers to work together to try to provide something beyond the government system, many times for their kids and their neighbors' kids, that was different. And really, over the last 20 years, we've seen it's actually been better in so many ways. I mean, especially when you look at those kids that were especially underserved in the old system, the kids whose parents couldn't buy them into a richer zip code.
Right.
The parents who, you know, the kids whose parents didn't have money to leave the system altogether and go to private schools. I mean, we're thinking about a lot here of our Black communities, Hispanic communities, kids often with disabilities, and of course the poor of all stripes. All of them, the data shows, perform better in charter schools. And a particular thing to note, Seth, is that Hispanic kids in Arizona, if you just take that one demographic, Hispanic kids in Arizona have higher NAEP scores. That's the national assessment of all kids throughout the country.
This is known as the Nation's Report Card, the National Assessment of Education Progress, right? Many of us think this is the single best test in measurement of academic achievement. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, and Hispanic kids in an Arizona charter school score higher than anywhere else in the country in that demographic. The fact of the matter is, if you look at the data, you really have incredible results to look at, and I think we can say on the whole the charter quote unquote experiment in Arizona has been incredibly beneficial to all kids.
And that has been my sense. There's a few myths that are out there, and then there are a few op-ed columnists who have the idea of charters in their gun sights. Eric, I wanted to take on some of what the impression is that they leave with the public that isn't as entrenched as you are or perhaps I am in this stuff. One of them is charters are an excuse for wealthy people to get wealthier off the backs of taxpayers. I wonder if you might say a word about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing is you can't lump all charters together.
Bingo.
There was 544 charters in Arizona,
right.
And I certainly don't speak for all charters. I know Great Hearts well. I've been working at Great Hearts for a decade, and so I can really only speak to Great Hearts. But the fact of the matter is, like in any system, and this is true in the district system, this is true in other industries, there are bad actors.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we have regulatory bodies and other instruments with which to hold those actors accountable. And you see that happening right now. Certainly in the charter sector, you see it happening in the Scottsdale Unified School District. I don't think we're gonna be able to get rid of bad actors entirely, but to take a few bad actors and to say or to assume or to suggest rather that an entire system should be blown up because of that is really absurd.
And it attends the other myth. It's attendant to the other myth, Eric. You addressed it a little bit in your opening comments, which is that charters, I guess the phrase is, like to just take the cream of the students. They have such good scores because they just take the cream off the top. They take students who they know are going to perform well on these tests and in these schools, and they leave behind the students who really could use the best practices in education.
Yeah, and that the data shows the exact opposite.
Right.
So if you look at a student in a district school leaving their district school and enrolling in a charter school, on average, those students score below the state average on the AZ merit exam.
There you go.
If you look at a kid in a charter school leaving a charter school and entering a district, on average, that kid scores above the average proficiency rate on the AZ merit exam. So the exact opposite of true of what some of the pundits are reporting.
And how well are charters doing, Eric, in the area of underrepresented communities? The theory being that charters in certain neighborhoods, and as you say, there are so many charters, so each one's going to be a little bit different, but charters in certain neighborhoods are just providing a free education of excellence to those who don't want to pay the prices of, say, a private school. How do we do with underrepresented?
Yeah, or can't.
Right, or can't.
Yeah. I mean, as I said earlier, that when you look at the actual data in every single subgroup that you could disaggregate in, all of those students perform better in charters.
Perfect.
And why that isn't on the front page of every publication that we have in the state is unfortunate.
Well, let me test a theory with you. I think I understand the theory as to why. You tell me what you think, because it is odd to me, this war, if it overused word, but war against the charters. It seems to me that there are two different concepts of public education at cross purposes here. There is a group of people who believe that public education means supporting the traditional system of public schools, pre-charter, whereas another view of public education is do whatever the heck it takes to educate the public within the means of the law. I fall in the second. I have always thought that public education should not be about institutions or systems. It should be about the children.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, at the end of the day, institutions aren't sacred. The only thing in the system that is sacred is the kid. And we, as long as someone in the public K-12 system is serving those kids well, they should be allowed to continue to operate. And I totally agree. Within the law, within the regulatory environment that we have, that we choose to have as a democracy, there are rules by which we should all be playing. And it certainly is the case that we as taxpayers, when we're putting money into the public system, we want to get an appropriate return on that. And we don't believe that it should be going to, in an unhealthy way, make private citizens wealthy at the expense of students. But the fact of the matter is that this idea that somehow the old system, the 19th century factory farm industrial education model with big box schools, one-size-fits-all government model, that somehow that is the sacred thing and that system has a right to each Arizona child, it just doesn't fit, one, with where we are at in the 21st century, and it does not fit with what moms and dads want for their own kids.
And what I think is also important here, Eric, is something I talk a lot about when it comes to education reform. You know, there was this book about 20 years or so ago by Diane Ravitch, back when I thought she was doing really good work on education reform, talking about all these different progressive education reforms that have suffused the education system and really diluted much of many schools' focus and losing their senses of mission. One of the nice things about charters, and I know it's true of Great Hearts where you are, is how well they can create a whole new focus, a whole different focus, a more traditional kind of education, the kind of stuff that maybe our parents and grandparents would know and understand, rather than the kind of methodological nonsense that only a 20-year-old would understand, if I'm right. Making sense. In other words, you still think Shakespeare's important. So do I. You can actually get that kind of an education in Arizona because of charters.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful thing, and we have over 13,000 students that were in our schools today here in Arizona, and another 10,000 that are trying to get in, Seth.
So that's an important point. So many are clamoring to get in. I have to run to a break. Do you have time for just a brief next segment after the other side of the break?
Absolutely.
Be right back with Eric Twist from Great Hearts Academies. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Delighted to have with us Eric Twist, the president of the Great Hearts Academies here in Arizona, one of several charter systems in the state. And we're talking about the series the Arizona Republic has been writing on charter schools, and wanted to provide a little more context, a little more information, a little more fact. Eric, you've been in education a long time, and from inside and out. I wonder if a fair question to you might be something along the lines of, everyone has their ideas about education reform. Everyone has touched education because they either have children in the system or they've been through it themselves. We all have. We all are. What would you say are some of the most important elements to get all our schools to do better jobs?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think, like we were saying earlier, the good thing to remember is that parents are not loyal to an institution.
Right.
They're loyal to anyone who will fulfill the promise of a great education. And that be that district, traditional district, charter, private, magnet, you name it. And so I think one of the things that we shouldn't lose as a state, and where the reforms really should be centered in many ways, not only, but centered, is on making sure that we can continue to allow educators in any of the institutions that we have currently, any of the systems, to continue to enterprise, to be creative, to come up with new ideas. I mean, you see this in the charter sector all the time. Most of them do wonderful things. Not all of them work. But you think about, I think about what's happening in Phoenix Union High School District, which is amazing. You have the Coding Academy, the Bioscience Academy. You have what the superintendent there is doing at South Mountain. These are innovative practices. And parents want to see change, and they want the system to allow teachers and administrators, thinkers and entrepreneurs within the space to do something different, something that your generation, my generation, didn't have, Seth. And so I think the most important thing we can do is to allow the people in the system to continue to innovate, to do things that they know best to do, and to allow parents to choose what they believe is best for their kids.
And is it appropriate to say schools, too, have a role, and maybe it's a role that they aren't used to, but are getting more and more used to, perhaps, because of charter and other legislation, which is a duty really to compete for students. As you said in the last segment, you know, there was a time that is over in Arizona, I think, where schools didn't have any incentives to reform or change any ossified practices. They had a claim on the students. And it's kind of a different age and a more innovative age, as every sector in our lives practices, where they compete for the students once, you know? Just
Which
never used to happen. Right. It just never used to happen.
No, it never happened. And parents are – here, they're loyal to their kids, Seth. No matter what demographic they're in, they will do anything for their children. And what they want more than anything else is an opportunity to give their kids a great education. And for them, that doesn't mean being stuck in one system or only having the option that your zip code can afford you, but having options beyond that. And that's exactly what Arizona has created. We should protect it. We should strengthen it. And I think the future's bright.
And you were talking about the success by virtue of waiting lists. Can you do that again? What was your waiting list numbers that you were talking about?
So we're going through enrollment right now, and so it'll probably pick up, but it always hovers around or above 10,000 kids just here in Arizona. Beth. We've got a few schools in Texas as well, but in Arizona alone, there are 10,000 kids that would take one of our seats if we had them. They sit there waiting.
Wow. Eric, it dawned on me there's another myth that is kind of left from the series, and I wondered if you, in the Republic, and I wondered if you might address it. And I know it would be difficult to do with specificity across all charter systems, you being only familiar with, most familiar with the one you're in, but this issue that it actually drains our state coffers, that it is actually more expensive to have the charter system we have, that it costs taxpayers more than if we did not have these charter schools.
Yeah, it for anyone that's running a charter school, staff, this notion completely confuses us. I mean, a charter school is an incredible deal for the state of Arizona. I mean, when we just look at the Great Arts finances, I mean, depending on the district that we're in, and we could spend a whole hour, Seth, on working through the nuances of the Arizona funding formula.
It's impossible. I don't know an hour. Yeah. I don't know about an hour, buddy. I've tried so hard. It is so hard to get numbers. Go ahead.
But when you look at just Great Arts academies in the districts that we're in, we're looking oftentimes at $2,400 difference per pupil in how we're funded next to the district school down the street. That comes out to anywhere between $48,000 and $72,000 less per classroom that the state is putting in.
Wow.
And then when you add to that on our per pupil amount, we have to pay our mortgage, right? We actually have facilities costs. Those costs are not covered by the local property taxes. You think about the total amount that the Arizona taxpayer is getting when they put their kid into a Great Arts Academy. It's an incredible deal, Seth. They're getting an education for free that in the state of Arizona, you can't even find a private school that you can go and get this type of education. You can't even pay for it here.
We're
doing it for oftentimes $48,000 to $72,000 less than the district school per classroom down the street.
Wow. Wow. That's the number. That is amazing. That is absolutely me. Well, Eric, thanks. I just want to encourage you, keep at it. Don't let the series get you down. And I just wanted to give another side to it because, recognizing some of the names they put in there, recognizing some of the facts, quote unquote facts they put in there, it just, you have to be, there's a rule in the media, a friend of mine in public policy taught me a long ago, the closer you are to knowing an issue, the more you see the media bias. And I just saw it so rife in this series that I really wanted to get you on the other side of it. And I really appreciate what you're tweeting out.
Well, Seth, thanks for having me on. Always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Eric. I appreciate you and everything you guys do and your teachers, several of whom are regular guests on this show. Godspeed to you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Al in Phoenix, thanks for calling in. How are you, Al?
Fine. Seth, how are you, buddy? I'm kind of really close to this. My wife works for the Arizona School Boards Association and is not, it's an interesting partisan. We actually, our kids went to a traditional public school, which was interesting back in the day. But
of which there are a great many great ones, I have to say. I am not in the position to say that there aren't. I know plenty that are as good as, if not better than certain charters and private schools. I have to go to a break. Can you hold the line and I'll come right back to you?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to get that out there too. This is not in any way a condemnation of one particular system, because I have traveled through a lot of different kinds of schools and there are some excellent, excellent public ones. I'm Seth Leibson, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960 on our education discussion. Al has been on hold from Phoenix. Thanks, Al, for your patience. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. You're welcome. First off, you know, if you're going to exercise when you're not feeling well,
yeah.
Just my dad's 93, been a marathon runner. You know what? When he didn't feel well, guess what? He did whatever he could and just powered through, and he just did whatever he could.
Okay,
know?
So yeah, this is the question I've been asking. So for anyone who's tuning in, I can't get a straight answer. This is on one side of it as to whether when you're in training, as I am, and I guess like your dad is, when you get a cold, should you continue? And I have seen that answer, Al, that people say, well, exercise up to the point where you just can't, where
you're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
If you're still comfortable, you know, slow it down, do a little of this, do a little of that, you know, whatever you can do within the confines of your stuffiness or whatever your malady is, you know. You know, as long as you're not infecting anybody or whatever.
Yeah. No, and I wouldn't go to a gym with a cold, so it's really a question of running outside. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just a matter of just finding the pace that you're comfortable with, that you can breathe and not, you know, asphyxiate yourself.
Yes. At that point, we know we have failed.
We have
pushed it just a little too far at the point of asphyxiation. All right.
But back to the schools, there's a lot of the problems with a lot of the schools is, It's the imbalance that districts provide. Little history, you can look it up. I was back in 1998, I was in candidate for governor, and one of the things I had talked about was how you balance school funding. And one of the things I talked about was the disparity of teacher pay. And what happens is it's all based on property taxes, which it shouldn't be. It should be more like the military. The state certifies teachers, so the state should pay the teachers. So districts can't shop teachers. You should, as a teacher, and basically in the public schools anyway, you should be paid the same in Yuma as you are in the Deer Valley School District. So you get quality across the board instead of disparity across the board based on property values. So districts can't buy teachers with the incentives that my property taxes are better than your property tax. And that would allow for better education across the board in the corporate world of public school. They live in the 1850s of public school. I actually wish they would live in the 1850s of public school. They live in the 1987s of public school, where the unions control everything.
I hear what you're saying.
Not the processes. You know, we've lost reading, writing, and arithmetic, and we've got social justice and feel
right,
good.
Right. We have lost the sense of mission in too many schools. We just really have.
And a lot of it.
And people don't even know what the mission is anymore. I mean, the mission is quite simple. It was to enhance basically the intellectual development of each child. We thought we knew how to do that once upon a time.
We did. And you know what's funny? Back, I was reading a story today. I saw one where they want to bring basic financial information to kids now. They want to teach basic, you know.
Oh, right. How to balance a checkbook, how to handle a credit card, something like that. Yeah.
Right. They taught home economics and that stuff I talked about 10 years ago about, you know, we should have economics in school about how to, you know, what this is what a lease looks like. Read the lease. This is what you're obligated for. How to lease a car, how to buy a car, how to buy a house, what mortgages are. Just basic stuff that some parents taught their children, they never really did, you know. But most families, you kind of learn it on your own because nobody was teaching.
Well, it would help with education sovereignty, too. It would help with education choices as students look at, look at what student loans are going to mean for them, you know, too.
Absolutely. Because
no one really thinks about that. And kid gets out of college at age 22, 3, 4, 5, depending, and he's already 100K behind, you know.
Yeah, my Ferrari is sitting in the college degrees on the walls of my kids.
Yeah, right, you know, right.
That's where my Ferrari was.
Yes, exactly. My dad's too.
Right.
Right.
The University of Miami cost, you know, that one didn't come cheap.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But it's an appreciative thing. You don't know the value of things.
Yeah. This theme keeps coming up. This theme keeps coming up again and again and again, whether it's in the healthcare debate or whether it's in other in proper government services debate or in the private sector. You know, you can only esteem what you value. And until we actually understand the prices and the costs, why would we expect anyone to put a value on these things? Right.
Right. And the health debate is two different things. Health insurance.
Right.
And health care costs.
Right.
And they try to meld them into two, into one, and they're not the same.
Absolutely. And every time I make that mistake, I appreciate the correction. Hey, Al, thank you so very, very much.
We'll talk to you again.
You betcha. I appreciate it. 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. This happened earlier today, earlier this morning. Some of these shows that we talk about on network television, the audiences can sometimes be substantial. Usually, the odd thing is the audiences tend to be bigger through the replays of them on the internet or the segments that are cut out, carved up, and sent around on the internet. This is true of interviews. It's true of the late night shows. It's sometimes true of the cable news network news as well, CNN particularly. Anytime Jim Acosta does something, it gets more attention on the internet than it does from actual viewers, which is probably a healthy sign. This from The View this morning in our ongoing efforts at exposing left-wing anti-Semitism. And that from the Women's March. Meghan McCain, boy, did she step up today with the two founders of the Women's March, and she was ready for them in a way that they were not ready, clearly. The two founders, of course, being Tamika Mallory and Bob Bland. That is the name of a woman, Bob Bland. This is a few minutes long, but Bill, if you can just follow me, I may want to stop and start along the way. But take a listen to this and to Meghan McCain going for the jugular here.
The first Women's March took place the day after the new guy was inaugurated on January 21st.
Guy, right.
And it became one of the largest protests in history, and it happened all over the country. You organized D.C. What was your response when you saw how people were coming out?
Well, I mean, it was incredible. You know, obviously the turnout and also just all of the emotion that went into the planning. We actually organized not just D.C., nationally and internationally. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of work that went into that day. And obviously the culmination of it was great. But many of us, particularly the women of color who stepped in to be leaders, we were called to come and be leaders of the march to ensure that the march was diverse. We weren't really shocked that people were so angry and had this such, you know, such of an intense feeling. Mm-hmm. We knew that this country was in trouble and that it was only before a moment in history that would come that we would all need to be called to the table to address it.
And I just, as a new activist, looking at 1.2 million women and allies just in D.C. alone, I saw that these are the leaders we've been waiting for. Mm-hmm. And we always wanted to see these women become the face of our leadership
Stop
and the face of the nation.
There. Why were the Women's March leaders the women we had been waiting for? Had we not had a very successful, I think very successful feminist movement? Fine to always bring in new voices, but this is just silly. And to think that people like Madonna, who spoke at the is the kind of leader when she talked about blowing up the White House, or Ashley Judd, that these were the leaders we were waiting for. If there's a fascination with Hollywood and actresses, okay, maybe. But it seems to me that there was a feminist movement that was pretty strong, pretty successful, and didn't traffic in, much less embrace and hug hate groups like anti-Semites. Go on, Bill.
And the face of the nation. And I think that's what we saw in the midterm elections, where we saw a historical outpouring of thousands of women running for office. Mm-hmm. And in the Congress alone, over 100 coming into Congress for the first time.
Well, there has been some controversy surrounding the Women's March organization. And Tamika, you came under some fire for your relationship with Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. Now, he's known for being anti-Semitic, for being homophobic, but you do attend his events and you posted, I believe, a photo together calling him the GOAT, which means the greatest of all time.
Stop it there. And you understand that she has called Louis Farrakhan, the greatest of all time. This is Sonny Hostin who's asking of Tamika this question, and they're putting up a picture behind Tamika Mallory. They have a picture of Louis Farrakhan and embracing Tamika Mallory. She has called him the greatest of all time. Go ahead.
Which means the greatest of all time. And you are running an organization that says it fights bigotry. Do you understand why your association with him is quite problematic?
No, I think it's important to put my attendance, my presence at Savior's Day, which is the highest holy day for the Nation of Islam, in proper context.
Okay.
You know, as a leader, as a black leader in a country that is still dealing with some very serious unresolved issues as it relates to the black experience in this country, I go into a lot of difficult spaces. I wrote a piece immediately following the beginning of this controversy talking about wherever my people are, that's where I must also be. So I also go into prisons where there are people who have been convicted of heinous acts. And I am trying to help people to move from wherever they are today and build that unity to bring them to a place where we live in a more fair and equitable society. And I think that that work is not easy for everyone to understand, but it's certainly work that I'm committed to. And everywhere that I go is difficult. The Women's March was very difficult. I met with a lot of women who did not even understand why race was important to be a part of the conversation as it relates to women's rights issues. And there was a lot of, you know, offensive rhetoric that I heard. And, you know, and just because you go into a space with someone does not mean that you agree with everything that they say.
Stop there. Yes, I'll let her push back. I have a lot to say about that very single point. By the way, I would be curious to know how much time she does spend in the prisons, and how many people in the prisons she has met with and counseled who actually are there for crimes they did not commit. That would be interesting to know. I'm going to tell you the answer is close to zero. Go ahead, Bill.
Back a little bit. Why call him the greatest of all time?
I didn't call him the greatest of all time because of his rhetoric. I called him the greatest of all time because of what he's done in black communities.
Which is what? Which is what? Selling anti-Semitism and anti-homosexual rantings. Based on, you know, I'm not going to take on religious beliefs, but as a minister, the beliefs are, shall we say, fairly astounding. Based on what has he accomplished in that community, I think he has misled large, large swaths of the community on whose behalf he speaks. Keep going. It is scary to me that there are people in the audience applauding this. Stop it. That perhaps is the most worrisome thing and tells you about the audience that is going into The View, that they can go in and applaud Tamika Mallory for saying, I do not say that Farrakhan is the greatest of all time for what he says, but for what he does in that community, and that was the one moment that got applause. That should frighten us. That should frighten us tremendously. We're going to go to a break in a second here, Bill. How much time do I have? Yeah, let's pick it up on the other side of this break so we can get the full context, and then Meghan McCain weighing in, and she just did a phenomenal job. But I want you to think, this is not whataboutism, this is hypocrisy and clarity. I want you to think about what it would mean for someone to say that they stood with a bigot or a racist, not because of what they said, but because of what they do and what they did in any given community. It's nonsense, and it has no purchase in any other context whatsoever, nor should it. These people are getting away with nothing short of bald-faced bigotry. Welcome back. We are talking about and airing a little bit of what took place on The View today with the founders of the Women's March having praised so heavily Louis Farrakhan, being called out for the bigotry he stands for, even as they call him the greatest of all time. Shortly, you'll hear Meghan McCain weighing in on fire. Go ahead, Bill, and keep playing some of this interview.
be comfortable supporting someone who called, "I'm not anti-Semite and I'm anti-termite. It's the wicked Jews, the false Jews that are promoting lesbianism, homosexuality." I actually spoke with the journalist from Tablet Magazine who released an investigation report on your organization. And in part, they allege that there is a lot of anti-Semitism surrounding this march. Specifically, the report alleged that you, Tamika, and co-founder Carmen Perez asserted that, quote, "Jewish people had a history of exploiting black people and were proven to be leaders of the American slave trade." Now, a lot of people, I include me in this, think that you're using your organization as anti-Semitism masked in activism and that you're using identity politics to shield yourself from critiques. You're talking about all women being invited to that march. I'm pro-life. We were not invited. We were not allowed at that march right there. I'm a conservative woman. I also represent, if you're talking about women, you should be talking about all women, including Jewish women as well, and conservative women.
Well, Megan, so are those allegations true? Well, first of all, those allegations are not true. That is not how that meeting happened. And the Women's March...
So the journalist I spoke to was lying?
The people that the journalist spoke to did not tell the truth.
Period.
Full stop.
That's it.
And I think it's important for us to understand and all be very clear in this room that the Women's March unequivocally condemns anti-Semitism, bigotry.
To condemn Farrakhan's remarks about Jewish people.
Yes, and we have repeatedly, in statement after statement this year, which are available directly on our website for anyone to read.
They've never done it.
We condemn any statements of hate, and we've actually
That's how they do it. They don't condemn
so
Farrakhan, they do a generic one.
To fight this type of hate.
You're fine. Keep it going.
Over and over again, and we're committed to repairing any harm because we understand that the Jewish community is feeling hurt right now, and we want to make sure.
I don't speak for Jewish people, but I think I'm just confused. Mm-hmm. These remarks are. I mean, it goes on death to Israel over and over again.
We did not make those remarks.
We did not make
you can't.
But
put
you're associating with a man
and
who
so
does
what
publicly.
What I will say to you is that I don't agree with many of Minister Farrakhan's statements.
You don't agree with that.
Jewish people.
That's
I said,
a pretty.
I don't agree.
That's about as weak as you can get. I don't agree with Minister Farrakhan. Keep going. Do we have just a little more?
With many of Minister Farrakhan's statements.
Do you condemn them?
I don't agree with these statements.
Stop.
At the end of the day.
Stop. How hard is it to condemn Minister Farrakhan? How hard is it to condemn this vile bigotry? She can't do it. I hope that this interview gets wide, wide circulation. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.